Welcome to Radio Gorgeous, Sarah Ward, author of Patient Fury, which is, I believe, your third novel.
That's right, yes.
Yeah, okay. Tell us about A Patient Fury.
So it starts off with a deadly house fire. My books are set in Derbyshire, the Derbyshire Peak District. And in Patient Fury, there's a deadly house fire, and the person who is believed to have committed the crime, there's a husband, a wife, and a young child found murdered. And it's believed that the wife is the killer of the family. But her husband, who was much older than her, had a first wife who mysteriously disappeared in the early 1980s. So Connie Charles, who's my main detective in the series, believes that there's something connected with the first case that will give a reason for why the fire happened and the killings happened in the present day. However, she comes up against her superiors, because all the forensic evidence suggests that it was Francesca, the mother, who killed her husband and child. And the book explores sort of the gender nature of family annihilations, if you can call it that, because they're often male crimes, and that this is one of the reasons my main detective, Connie, doesn't believe it could happen, that a woman would kill her child and her husband. It just doesn't fit the pattern of that type of crime.
And particularly, which I'm not going to give anything away, but particularly as we find out the woman in Francesca's particular circumstances. You explore, as you say, you do in this novel darkly, one must admit, explore female stereotypes in relationships. And not stereotypes, you play with them a lot.
Yeah.
You play with, in particular, expectations of mothers. What mothers are supposed to be willing and unwilling to do. What mothers are supposed to want and not want. And it also seems to me there's a very... secrets are also another big theme.
Yes.
And I'm also thinking of your previous book, A Deadly Thaw, which I read, is that the central female characters both keep secrets out of a very English sense of loyalty, I think.
That's really interesting. I've never really seen it as an English thing. I definitely see it as a small town thing. So my books are set in the Peak District, and it's a rural community, and the towns are small there. And I grew up not there. I grew up in the neighbouring county, but again, in a small town. So you walk down the road and you see someone you know. There's one high school, so you know everybody in your year. There's one doctor's surgery. And it's that's quite familiar for a lot of people, even if they live in London, for example. A lot of people grew up in small towns. And what I'm really keen on in my crime books is to make the crime applicable to the setting. There's no point me having a serial killer in a field, for example. You know, it has to be relevant to where I live. And what happens, in small towns, is that the crimes have a long genesis. They have a long period leading up. There's no accidental killers. They have they can sometimes suddenly explode into this really sort of fiery crime, but there's usually a big history. And there's sort of two reasons for that. One is family secrets, so what's happening behind closed doors, because in the Peak District we're very high up. In the summer I see my neighbours, I say hello. In the winter I see nobody. Everybody's behind their doors in the warmth, and it's what's going on behind those closed doors. So that's sort of the family aspect, and all my books sort of play on, as you said, mothers and relationships within the family and relationships between parents and children. But also, it's long-held secrets in these small towns. And what you often find is, so this was particularly in my second book, A Deadly Thaw, but to quite an extent in the next book, A Patient Fury, is that secrets can be open secrets that everybody knows about them, but nobody speaks about it. So it's still a secret, and but everybody knows about it and it remains unspoken. So secrets, I haven't necessarily thought of it as an English thing. Do you think it's English to be secretive?
No, but to the secrets kept out of shame, that shameful, it would, and sort of not wanting to make a fuss.
Oh, yeah.
Not wanting to make a big stink of it.
Yeah, no, I can see
Whereas
that.
I think in other cultures, maybe America is like, well, that's the truth. Yeah. It's got to come out.
Yeah.
That used to be. Now we're into fake news.
Yeah.
But you know what I mean? That there's more of an expository, you know, there's... I think it's an English thing in that there's something more important than truth in, as you say, communal life.
Yes. Yeah. No, I can definitely see that. Mm. And it's quite interesting when I talk about my books, I can talk about them virtually anywhere because people know that type of thing. They can recognise that in a community. And so, you know, it's based, for example, on my grandfather. My parents are Welsh. So my grandfather grew up. And then he found out as an adult that the people he thought were his parents were actually his grandparents, and the person he thought of his sister was actually his mother. And it's that kind of... But all his family knew, but nobody told him. So it's that kind of open secret. It's not like really, you know, she didn't have him in private. It's just that the whole family closed ranks. And so it's an open secret, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's more of collusion.
Mm, exactly.
And how families, communities... collude in these stories supposedly for the greater good, but exactly. Like all of those good intentions, they come to shite in the end.
Well, that's it. Yeah, well, there's no novel, is there?
Exactly. You know, we got to get to the crack.
Exactly.
The
exactly.
Dirty underbelly.
Exactly. And I think that's true in real life. I think you keep a secret, and the thing is about secretive people. This isn't a criticism, but when you've got a secret, you think it's my secret, and if I don't want to tell anybody, then I won't. But of course, secrets don't work like that. Maybe you die and your children find out, or maybe affect somebody and they've been affected by the fact you've kept a secret. And where you've got something like that, you've got a crime novel, really. And also, I think what is an English sense is just get on with it. You know, we do definitely have that. And so in A Patient Fury, Peter Winston's first wife, Elizabeth, disappeared. She pinned a note on a shop saying, "Oh, back in 2 minutes," and she's never seen again. And you get a sense of, although they've really damaged the family by the fact she's done that, they just move on. They just up sticks, they move county, and they carry on with their lives, and eventually Peter Winston remarries. And I think that's a very English thing to do, is just like, oh, well, you know, mum's gone, let's, you know, just carry on. And it's the reverberations of what might happen if you do that.
Yeah, because what I sense... because I grew up sort of with that same kind of open secret. Mm. And I remember my mother saying, well, it wasn't a secret. Like, yeah, but, you know, the fact that we were all adopted. I was like, yeah, but we never talked about it, ever.
Right.
Like, everyone knew not to mention it.
Right,
so it's like, don't mention the elephant in the room kind of thing. So, yes, while it's not a secret, that turgid atmosphere that you sense that the children, that Peter's two children grew up with.
Yes.
Is poisonous.
Mm, exactly. I mean, and you don't want to make your characters cardboard. So damaged people, I think, act in different ways. And it isn't always apparent. So you try not to sort of make them psychopaths or completely unlikable. Lots of people are likable and unlikable at the same time. So
or understandable and unlikable.
Yeah.
Or...
You exactly.
Know, some combination of that.
Yeah, and it's quite interesting because my first book, In Bitter Chill, had a girl who was abducted in the 1970s with another girl who was never found, but my protagonist was the other girl that sort of escaped. And a few people said, oh, I didn't really warm to her. I don't think she was a warm character. And I thought, well, you wouldn't be really, would you? It's that sort of...
Not open and trusting and sunny.
No, you're going to be prickly and so on. But I'm also really concerned not to have women as victims. So virtually all my characters, if they're involved in a crime that's happened to them, they're often trying to find out what happened. And that's really important for me, that they're not passive observers. So my books always have two sort of narratives. There's whatever's happened, there's a police investigation that's happening with my detective, Connie Childs, and Frances Sadler, her boss. But then every other chapter is told from a different protagonist point of view, depending on what the story is. And they're female, because that's what I'm interested in. I'm interested in women's lives. And they look at it from a sort of civilian point of view, because... They're not just police procedurals, my books. that's really interesting. I love Rebus. I like Peter Robinson's Banks books. So I'm a big fan of police investigations. But as a reader, we don't really know what the police do. And so I think we often identify with a person who's not in the police, who's trying to sort it out from a sort of civilian... civilian's not really the right word, from a non-detective point of view. So my protagonists, who aren't the police, are often trying to find the solution themselves, which, you know, sort of helps, I think, the reader identify that this is what they would possibly want to do.
Yeah, because we do. We are.
Yeah.
I mean, we are entranced by these stories anyway. Mm. We are curious. We want to know. We want to know why.
Exactly.
We want to know how. And how could I be a person that did that, you know, potentially?
Exactly. Because I grew up, I mean, reading a lot of Golden Age crime, Agatha Christie and so on. And it was enough in the Golden Age just to know who did it. You didn't need to know why. Now you've got to have a realistic background, and it's the influence of psychological thrillers and so on, but it's good that the psychological element has come into books, because readers want to know why, and also they often want a resolution. They want some kind of penance, or even if there isn't a penance, if you have to subvert that slightly, they have to know that they're being denied that almost.
Yeah.
So I think the crime novel has become much more sophisticated, and readers' expectations have risen. So you can't have this grand reveal like Poirot around a room, you know, you did it. It's got to be much more subtle than that.
Although that was always a great fun.
I love those. I know, I love those.
But I wouldn't want to be caught in St. Mary Mead.
No.
It's horrible. It's a deadly place.
She is, isn't it? Yeah.
And speaking of place, as you said, it's very apparent that location is superbly important to you. Mm. Other than it's a small town and it's where you are, so you obviously know it. When reading other novels, what does location provide for you?
Well, it's really interesting because location has become more important in crime novels generally. When I sort of was reading, sort of in my teens, P.D. James, Ruth Rendell, they created their own worlds that were in that particular setting. So it has gradually become more important in British crime fiction. I think it was quite influenced by Scandinavian crime novels, the Nordic noir novels, because setting is integral to the plot. So if you take someone like Arnaldur Indridason, who's an Icelandic crime writer, his books couldn't be set anywhere else. They're all the sort of descriptions of the Icelandic ice fields and so on. And I really took that. So the Peak District is quite a special place. It's quite high up. So my village is one of the highest in England. And the weather's very inclement during the winter, and you try and incorporate that. So it's not like this is what's happened, oh, and it's happened in the Peak District. It's happened almost because it's in the Peak District, because of the setting, because of the closed community, because of the weather, because of the climate, because the fact that the weather's so inclement, we do rely on our neighbours. So you can knock on the door, but you haven't seen them for a while. It's that sort of... And we get a lot of tourists in the summer, and there's a sort of feeling of when they've gone, oh, it's back. Is it back to normal, or is the tourist normal? Which is sort of normal? And that really helps sort of the crime setting, really. So I would say setting is integral to it. But I'm also interested in sort of the countryside as well. So A Patient Fury incorporates various myths and ghost stories to do with the Peak District. And we've all got, I think every English county, and it's not always brought out in crime novels, has its own traditions and stories. And I try and work them into the book because it's really interesting and they get lost otherwise. So I try and give a feel of people who've been around for a long time and the sort of stories they tell of a ghost who might appear, or an old bank that's deserted and now they think they can hear someone money being counted. And they're all sort of, they're a mixture of snippets that I hear, and then of course with fiction you integrate them into the plot. But that's really important as well, that this sort of, I wanted to feel quite English, quite British in feel, really.
Yeah. Yes, because not only are, you know, our folklore is part of our history as well, as you start the book out, you know, in in the Derbyshire churches, you know, those small chapels.
Yes.
As well as the physical history, there is there is a cultural history that you bring to your novels.
It's true. I'm really interested in folk horror. So now my books are not horror, but I'm interested in, I watch quite a lot of the TV series and films. And what you find with folk horror films, it's like the fear of the outsider. And it's a sort of sense of a community being very isolated. And when anything goes wrong, either through an outsider coming in, so if you think like the Wicker Man, that
I
sort
was,
of thing.
That's exactly what I was saying. I was like, okay, if that's the pinnacle, what else
can we have? Yeah. Or it's somebody within the community who's acting in a way that's not right for the community. Now, my books don't go that far because they're not horror novels, but that's what I'm interested in, the sort of folk horror almost element, the insularity that I find really fascinating, and you can just bring parts of that into a book, you know.
Okay, and so tell me how you said you know grew up reading Agatha Christie, etc., because I'm interested in how you came to writing, and I'm also interested in your blog because you're a reviewer.
That's right.
So I think it's called Crime Pieces?
That's right, yes.
Okay, and so what are you looking for when you're, you know, how have you developed as a crime reader, and what are you looking for when you're reading? And I'm going to just add another element in here and let you run with it. You're also on the board of Patrona.
Yes, that's right.
Which is, as we mentioned before,
Scandinavian
noir. Okay. Yeah. Circle back.
Right, so I've always been a reader, and that's one of those things that I've just loved since I was a child. So Enid Blyton, did Enid Blyton make it to America?
No,
she was a very British writer. But she had a series called The Secret Seven and The Famous Five. And The Secret Seven were a group of kids who used to investigate crimes. And then from then on, I went on to Nancy Drew. Now, you definitely had her, didn't you, Nancy Drew? And then The Golden Age Crime. And then in my 20s, I was reading P.G. James, Ruth Rendell, and then went on to Scandinavian crime fiction. So I've always loved crime fiction. And then in the early days of the internet, I met somebody who was reviewing crime novels on a new website. They created their own website called Crime Squad. And so I started doing my own reviews on that, and that was really great. And it was in the early days, and publishers weren't really sure what blogs were, so we sometimes got free books and sometimes we just, you know, we bought our own, and so it was a real mix of things. And then what happened was I moved to Athens in Greece to teach for a few years, and the sort of books dried up because a publisher's not going to send you a novel, this is my new crime novel, and send it to Greece. So what I did was I created my own blog called Crime Pieces, and I did it as a mixture, and this is what it is still. It's a mix of everything I read. It's a personal critical review. They're personal critical reviews of books that I read, and it could be something that's sent to me, it could be something I've seen in a bookshop and I've bought. It's often classic crime, so I collect the Green Penguin books and I read those and review them. It can be maybe I've given a talk, because I do talks on crime fiction, and I might put the text of my talk up there. It's very much a personal thing, and that's how I've kept my readership going over the years. When they come to my blog, and there's lots of great blogs out there, and each of them have a distinctive character, when they come to my blog, they know they're going to get probably either the latest crime novel and a review, or they're going to get a classic crime review, so of something that's possibly out of print, or I've got a big focus on translated crime fiction, including Nordic noir, but I'm also interested in other European crime fiction from Spain, France, or whatever. And so they come knowing that's the title. And so that's my readership, really. People are interested in those three aspects. And people have been with me for years and years and years, because for a Patient Fury that I've been running a series of competitions this week. And the amount of people that have come and entered the competition to win various things, all connected with those. So I'm giving away Scandi books and so on. And it's people who I know from who've been with me for years and years and years. And it's great because there's lots of other blogs and we're not in competition with each other. Everyone has got their own dynamic, really. And so that's what I do. And I've made it focused so people who come to the blog don't necessarily, it's not a writer's blog. I don't talk about, I only did 300 words today, because there's lots of other great websites who do that and writers who have their own blog. It's very much a book focused, and it helps me keep my sort of reading focused away from my writing. My writing happens with me in a little room in Derbyshire stressing, and occasionally I have a little sort of a moan on Facebook, but other than that, it's something that I do myself, really. Crime Pieces is much more a book-focused reviewing site. Yeah.
Excellent. So that's sort of like your book club.
Yes.
Your sort of social life.
Yes, it
Where's
is.
Where's the solitary writing life?
Yes, that's
and
right.
And how did you... What gave you the courage to turn from a reader to a writer?
Well, I'd always wanted to write a crime novel, but when I was working in London, I worked in the public sector, and then when I moved to Greece, I had a lot more time. And I remember sort of turning 40 and thinking, it's now or never. If I don't write this book, I'll get to 50, 60, and I think, oh, I could have written a book, or might have been able to. So I wrote In Bitter Chill, my first draft. So in the Athenian heat, I wrote this really cold crime novel. And I came back from Greece with this manuscript, went back to live in Derbyshire, was teaching in Manchester, and I met my agent at a party. I was just talking to her and I said, oh, I've written something. And she said, asked me to send it to her, and she said, oh, no, you know, she gave me quite a lot of comments, but and I've been with her ever since, so it was a really great story, really. And then Faber acquired it, so and I'm with Faber now, so it's been a really, really nice story. But there was a lot of work that went into that first manuscript. I was working on it for about 2 years before it even sort of saw light of day. So I think, in common with a lot of writers, my first book is the most worked on book, you know, ever since, really. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And tell me a bit about the Patrona Award.
So we set up the Patrona Award when I was blogging in...
With we?
Oh, so there's four of us. There's Karen Meek from Eurocrime. She runs a website called Eurocrime. There's Barry Forshaw, who's a crime fiction reviewer, a newspaper reviewer. And there's Dr. Kat Hall, who is an academic at Swansea University, who also has a blog called Mrs. Peabody. And we were all very friendly with a book blogger called Maxine Clark, who was a very early a proponent of Scandinavian crime fiction. A lot of her blog was dedicated to that. And Maxine sadly died in 2012, and we wanted to set up something in her memory. So we set up in 2013 the Patrona Award, and for the first award we used Maxine's reviews of the previous year to work out who she'd obviously liked the most, and it was awarded to... subsequently since then it's been an award that we get the books, they're submitted, we look at them, we judge them every year in March, and then we announce the winner at Crime Fest. The Crime Fiction Festival have been very supportive of the award, and so at the gala dinner before everyone eats we stand up and award the Patrona, and they get a free ticket to they get a little goblet and so on, and they get a free ticket to the following year. So Gunnar Stahlsen from Norway won it this year, which was really great.
Fantastic. Yeah. And your book launched yesterday.
It did, yes.
Fantastic, congratulations.
Thank you.
And I understand that you are on a little blogging tour.
That's
Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, blog tours are a sort of thing that's happened in the last couple of years. So it's like a virtual tour. So if you imagine an author going around the States or the Britain or whatever, visiting various bookshops, which I also do. So I go to bookshops. I was at a bookseller Crow bookshop in Crystal Palace last night, and I'm doing lots of library and bookshop events. But also it's quite nice to reach out, especially as I'm a blogger myself, to people who don't have access to these events. So a blog tour is a two-week tour in my case. So and each day a blogger reviews the book on their website, and so you reach a different readership, because obviously not everybody who looks at those blogs looks at mine or looks at something else. So it reaches their readers. It means the reviewers are getting to read your book and give their comments on it, and it just helps get it out there. And most bloggers are very good at social media. They're very good at tweeting, Facebooking, Instagramming, and so it creates this sort of buzz, really. So when we were in the lift, Faber said, you know, Josh from Faber was saying that he'd heard, he'd been on Twitter and he could see all these blog tour retweets. And that's just really, really helpful to give it a push, really, that maybe, so if I go to a bookshop and there's 30 people there, that's 30 people that've heard about my book. With social media, you never know the reach because it's just infinite, really. And so they're really helpful, blog tours, yeah.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Sarah Ward.
Well, thank you for having me. That's great.